Good afternoon. So, last time we talked a bunch about. See, my tablet's not working. About other details about how ASLR ends up working and, you know, how we might consider using information leaks to defeat it. And one key detail we went over is that libraries and executables generally stay together. This is because when a linker produces an executable, usually it's the case that we're going to have relative references to different segments of that executable between each other. So like if we have some code that references a global variable, we don't want to have to do something complicated to get the global variable's value, like look up in a table where the global variable is. Instead, we'll just say, oh, this is all loaded together. But that means, as far as information leaks, that we don't actually need to like get the precise address of each variable we want to access. Anything within a library or executable will often get us the address of everything else within the library or the executable. We also talked about sort of why this notion of address space layout randomization wasn't just something that's always turned on, that we can always do. And the big issue is that position independent code, that is code that, you know, doesn't have hard-coded addresses, isn't free. Especially on some platforms like 32-bit x86, where most of the instructions that were available to the compiler didn't use relative addressing. 64-bit x86 kind of fixed this, but that cost meant that usually executables and sometimes libraries wouldn't really support having your executable or library loaded at a random location. We also saw, kind of relative to thinking about this trade-off, that Windows made a different choice as far as how it dealt with loading executables at different locations. In Linux, they said, well, if you're going to have me load this executable or library at some arbitrary location, you have to prepare the code so it can be loaded wherever. It has to be what we call position-independent code. In Windows, they said, okay, we're going to do some fixing up of the code in order to load it. So that means that we should be able to, provided things are compiled and linked correctly, load programs at libraries at different locations, but we have to edit the code as we load it, so the loading is going to be a bit slower. And it also means that if you want to manage the overhead of that, well, you don't want to have to keep editing it for each different version. And what Windows chose to do for that is to usually, once we edit the code once, to keep that library or executable loaded at that location each time we keep reusing it, rather than having two or three or four different versions of, say, the C standard library in memory at once. We'll just have one version, we've chosen a random address for it, but we're gonna use that one random address, you know, over and over again until we reboot and need to reload that library. So then we looked at sort of one concrete example of sort of an exploit that defeated ASLR. And this was a recent bug that was in sudo where some security researchers investigated, well, is this actually exploitable? And found out that it was. And it was exploitable despite sudo, you know, kind of using all the protections that we're used to. Like the stack wasn't executable, you couldn't do stack smashing, and the bug was actually a heap overflow. And there was address space layout randomization, which sounds like it should make it really hard to have a reliable exploit, especially because every time you start sudo on Linux, it's going to choose different addresses. So like, it's not like you can leak information the first time and use it the second time. But they didn't need an information leak. They defeated it by just changing the low bits of the pointer, relying on, you know, an address they wanted being a fixed distance from an address that would have already been present. And, well, the low bits wouldn't always be exactly what they expected, but it would happen one out of 4,000 times. And, well, you know, if you are running sudo until it gives you root privileges when it's not supposed to, well, you can afford to run it 4,000 times. After looking at ASLR, we talked a bit about so-called heap smashing. And this was the idea that, well, stack smashing said, you know, if we have an overflow on the stack, there's this generic technique. And the heap, it's not as convenient for attackers as the stack is, because there are actually a variety of ways that malloc and free and other things that manage the heap might be implemented. But a very common technique is to have linked list of free objects, because, you know, linked lists are a very convenient data structure for adding things and removing things dynamically. And commonly we want to reuse memory in a malloc implementation after it's been freed. But this means that there often are pointers in pretty predictable locations after memory that's allocated on the heap. And we can use that these pointer subterfuge techniques we talked about earlier, where, well, we change a pointer and we know the program's going to use that pointer. So we can take advantage of changing that pointer to write to memory somewhere else. And we can use this with the linked list manipulations to actually turn something that is going to be a linked list removal into an arbitrary pointer array, because we can control these next and free and prev pointers that will be used by that linked list operation. And given things like the global offset table or other interesting, you know, pointers to code that might be in the program, we can then use this to actually, you know, have a reliable way of taking advantage of a heap overflow where we didn't have to get lucky and have that overflow go into something with like a vtable pointer and figure out exactly what object was there. We could kind of just know the malloc implementation works this way, therefore this will work. And finally, we started our what will be our first topic for today, which is about use after free vulnerabilities. So a common type of bug, which isn't an overflow, is that we access memory we're not supposed to because we can fool a program into freeing an object and still using a pointer to it. That the program just has some logic where it uses a pointer to something that's freed. And usually we think of this as sec vaulting, but commonly an attacker might be able to manipulate the program to allocate something that goes in its place. And because we have these two objects that the program thinks are different objects that are in the same place, we can sort of control what the freed object does using the unfreed object or vice versa. And we'll look at that in more detail as our first topic for today after I go over any questions people have about things we covered last time or maybe about the quiz, given that apparently there people were confused on that. Sure. So can I explain how to do question 3 on the quiz? So in question 3 on the quiz, we showed you here's the object dump output for something. And I gave you a bunch of addresses. And we wanted to figure out where the function pointer f, which is loaded here. And object dump knows that this is at offset 4010 in the executable, like at least relative to this. Like if we take this hex number and add the amount to get this number, that's the distance between them in memory. And when this is loaded, you know, the sort of base address of this executable is going to be different, but let's say it's loaded at address 1,000,000. Well, we're just going to add 1,000,000 to all these addresses we see here. So our goal is just to figure out what that difference is. And we have a bunch of these candidates that we can use to like try to figure that out. So I think the easiest one to use is this one here, that when this put s is called, I should have said f put s, not put s plt, but it's the only call to anything in Qux. The value push to return address is this, Well, that's a pointer to this instruction here, because that's where we're going to return to. And so I can know that the offset is, you know, whatever is going to be what makes this difference work. Another way I could have figured it out is that this 2004 became RDI, which is this value. So I can say, oh, you know, if I, this is 2004, it turns into this, and figure out what the difference is from that. And the same thing, and RAX, well, it seems like it's probably in the same memory region as RDI and the return address, but we don't actually know what it is in this context. But we can look at either of these because we know what their values are to figure out what the that difference is, and then we just add that difference to the address of F that we have object dump decoding for us here. So follow-up questions on number 3? Question, the difference was OX4FE000. That sounds about right, yes. As for the questions of whether there's partial credit for being off by a little, probably I need to go through and manually grade it. Which I obviously haven't had time to do yet. So then other questions. So 4B here. So question... So we're asking about strategies to prevent that heap smashing we talked about. And this idea of placing them at the end of regions of the heap doesn't make them any less accessible. So there's a question, wouldn't this mean that we corrupted an overflow? Well, if that's true, then that would make things easier. It wouldn't be the case that we'd automatically corrupt these pointers in overflow. It would make it less likely to happen because they would be, we'd have to corrupt the pointers in a free object because these pointers don't exist in an unfreed object yet. But we'd still be able to get to the pointers in a freed object. We just have to overflow our heap allocation by more. So it wouldn't prevent this attack.
Okay, thanks. That makes sense. I was thinking that like when it overflows, it would overwrite the like currently allocated heap object. It would overwrite the next and previous pointers. But since it doesn't have next and previous pointers, then it should be fine.
Yeah, and it's about preventing it. So if we can overwrite other pointers, that probably makes things easier for the attacker because there's more things they can attack. So let's see other questions. For questions ones, wouldn't D be useless unless you actually knew the RSP. I agree. So for this to work, we kind of need to know what RSP is in order to figure out what the address, where this return instruction will end up reading our return-oriented programming chain from. But we kind of need a information leak in either case. To make any of these, any sort of version of point to our return-oriented programming chain work. So I think it's still the best option. If we think of the sort of most popular, second most popularly chosen option here, this doesn't really work out because we're going to end up jumping to the stack and that's not executable. So this will always seg fault, assuming the stack isn't executable. And well, if the stack's executable, why would we be using a return-oriented programming chain? And also, if we want to run a return-oriented programming chain, jumping to the stack probably isn't going to help us unless we have some way of putting useful code on the stack, which seems hard to do when one of these has to be a string pointer.
What's the difference between jumping to the stack and like jumping to whatever's in RSI? Because I thought like it would jump to like whatever's stored at the top of the stack, and then it would just go to whatever RSI has, whatever address RSI has.
Okay. Oh, you thought this would read from RSI. So that would be written with parentheses in AT&T syntax or brackets in Intel syntax.
Okay, thanks.
At least I hope so. Or else. So the question is for 4B, does the attacker now need to know the size of the free region to do this? Yes. The attacker kind of needs that sort of knowledge anyways, because, you know, if malloc allocates a little extra space, you know, because, you know, it doesn't find something that's exactly the right size, you know, there's going to likely to be a little padding anyways. So yes, this makes it more tricky, but it doesn't really prevent it. And notably, the attacker can do something like just put the values they want for the next pre-even pointers in a pattern over and over again. So they could like make one overflow that handles multiple possible values for the size. And question four, you figured that if the implementation did D, that would eliminate the need for a linked list. I agree that not using a linked list would be a great strategy to prevent this attack. I wasn't intending to imply that type of change by saying we always put them at the beginning of a page. So question, why do we need to modify the stack pointer to run the ROP chain? So a return-oriented programming chain is based on these return instructions. And the return instructions read from where the stack pointer is. And that's why it works. So in order to start it, we need to point the stack pointer at the, you know, the set of things we want to be read by these return instructions, so it will jump to the place we want. Other questions on the quiz or about things we covered last time? The question is, if this jump instruction here didn't have a star, would it be a syntax error? I'm pretty sure that's yes. Okay, check that quickly. It's a warning. It does the same thing as with no star, but it gives a warning in the GNU assembler. So it's not an error, but it's not, jump RSP is not something that the assembler wants you to write. So a question is for this option, would setting an address to a buffer with the ROP chain in the string work for number two? So you're asking for number two if making the string not contain the ROP chain itself, but contain a pointer to it, like the address of a pointer to it would work. Is that your proposal? So problematically, this first return instruction will jump to the place specified by in the string, dump to an address specified in the string. And an ROP chain is not something we jump to. It's something we want returns to read from. So that wouldn't quite work out. Does that answer that question? Follow-ups?
Yeah, sorry. I was trying to type something, but it's quicker to just say it. So I was confused that in question two, it's moving the second parameter into RSP, and then the return is going to jump to whatever was in whatever is at that location. So it's going to pop off whatever it's pointing to at the new RSP and then jump there. And so you have to know, is what we're looking for at the location that we're about to point the stack pointer to? Right?
Yes, but the way an ROP chain works is that we exactly want to like pop the first thing off and go there. Because remember, like we wrote the sequences of these gadget addresses.
Right, yes. So, go ahead.
So this is exactly what we'll start, go to that first gadget.
Right. I just mean that when you're adjusting the RSP, whatever is right at the new address of the RSP is what's going to be used to jump to, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so that should be the first. So at the beginning of the string, therefore, would need to be the first thing we want to run.
Not the address of the first thing we want to run.
So remember, the string is likely is a pointer already.
Okay.
Right, because that's how it's a char star. Okay. So even though we're putting in a string, it's being passed as a pointer already. The program's done that for us. We don't like need to figure out where it's located. Other follow-ups, other questions? Okay, so let's move on. So I'm gonna move on then with talking about use after freeze. So sort of the classic case of a use after free vulnerability is like we allocate some object, say, foo, and we somehow accidentally delete it and then still call a method on it. And in the meanwhile, some other operations happen that use the heap where we can end up putting something else in the place where foo was. Now, in a real sort of use after free case, we're not going to be most likely so silly as to actually delete this variable and do that. Most likely what will happen is we'll have, you know, some extra pointer, you know, saved equals the foo, and we'll call something on that save pointer, not having realized that in between when we saved it and made that call, that the thing we saved went away. And in a large program, like classic examples like a browser, you know, there's lots of places where we might like save a pointer to something and not realize how the memory that thing points to is being managed, you know, precisely. So when we get to this situation where something else sort of replaces the foo, well, we have these sort of two views of the same memory, that we can view it as a bar object and a foo object. And this bar object has replaced, you know, the information in foo. And notably, let's say bar has a V table. Well, now This points to bar's V table, and this call to something, if it uses the V table, you know, this now calls some bar method. So that seems like it's going to cause something unexpected, and, you know, that could cause a lot of problems. And if we imagine maybe instead of getting a bar object, maybe if we get like a, you know, a buffer where here we have the user input being stored, well, that would be mean we could control where the vtable pointer points. But even this sort of case where we don't really get to control, you know, exactly what gets run, this could still is likely, like, let's say the bar method like prints out a number from the data for bar here. Well, it's actually printing out part of foo. That's like, that's an information leak right there. And if we can control this, if this whole object like contains our input, like the program malloc space for that, well, we can just set this pointer to point wherever we like. So the general pattern that this is used to attack this is, well, we need to actually sort of set up this situation where we have this bar object or some user input buffer happen to coincide with where this dangling pointer goes. You might say that seems awfully tricky, and well, it probably is, but, you know, in many real programs, we can kind of increase our chances of getting it right. So one thing we can do is that if the program has a bug where it frees something and then keeps using it, well, we can try a lot of times. We can get lots of objects that look like that. And we can make sure after we trigger these bogus frees, you know, the things that were free but really shouldn't have been, we can make sure we allocate a whole bunch of copies of the thing we want in its place. And hopefully one of them will end up taking up the slot of the thing that we freed afterwards. And because we can often do this, especially in, you know, sort of some concerning context for this, like, say, in JavaScript in a browser, we can have a pretty good chance of success. If we don't have this flexibility, well, we just have to look very carefully at how the malloc implementation works to, like, make this work out. So let's think about what we want to do, sort of this hypothetical example. So let's say here, my vulnerable code, I allocate an IF stream to read from a file here, and my use after free is I delete it and then call the get method. And when I do this deletion, well, it's going to call the destructor of the iStream object. And the way iStream is implemented in the C++ standard library is that actually there's a second object called a stream buff, and it has a method for getting the next character called uflow for underflow, because it's a buffer, and basically if it underflows, that means that we need to get more characters. And this is a virtual method, and there's some concrete implementation of this for files. There's a different implementation, like for a stream that reads from a string. And if we think about exploiting a use after free bug, we kind of want to end up having this call to uflow call, you know, our shell code, let's say, or trigger an ROP chain, probably more realistically, assuming we have mitigations in our binary. So to do this, so I have two questions. So one is that, you know, to do this, we're going to try to have this buffer that holds our input, you know, end up being stored in the same place as something that got deleted here. So this delete here, it deleted the iStream, it deleted this file stream buff, and possibly some other things that the iStream used. And commonly, malloc implementations are going to try to be space efficient. So they'll try to use some space of the same size to store this new buffer. So by controlling what the size of this buffer is, we can make it more likely that it occupies the space previously used by one of these objects. That have this. Let's think about sort of what size do we want for this input in order to make it likely, you know, assuming the allocator works in that way where it tries to match the same size, you know, as one size free space to one size, you know, new object, what size should we choose? And where in our whatever object we're replacing do we actually want to put the address the pointer, you know, of the code we want the program to run. So, for example, the gadget we're going to use to actually start an ROP chain. I hope I'm showing a poll. Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, so we do not have consensus. So I'll go through sort of what object do we want to target. So I think the simplest thing to target as far as our use after free bug is probably that we want something that will be confused for this call. So this get here, this does not use a vtable. This is not a virtual function. So because of that, we're not going to be likely to be able to replace the iStream object and have that directly go somewhere. We're going to have to rely on what this get function does internally, which is this call here. So probably the easiest way to do that is to hope to replace the stream buff. So we could try to replace this iStream, but if we got this buffer to replace the iStream, we then need to make this buff here point to a useful place. So that's doable, but it's a lot more complicated than if we can hopefully make this get us something that replaces the stream buff it points to, which was also freed. And therefore will also be used after being freed within this get method, assuming this pointer hasn't been changed. So if we want to replace the stream buff, so we have these two options. We could try to match the size of a file stream buff or a stream buff. And if we think of how this buff was set up in the IF stream constructor, this probably did something like buff equals new underscore file stream buff. It made the subclass version of it, and that's what memory was allocated for. So if we want to replace what this buff points to, you know, if we want our allocation to go to the same memory address by sort of this coincidence that, you know, we're just reusing free space, we probably want to match the size that previously stored a file stream buff. So I think that's the best size to choose. So you could try to make this work by replacing the IF stream object that was allocated and hoping to make this buff point somewhere useful. That would also be another reasonable strategy for the attacker. But if you can just replace the stream buff instead, that would be less steps. So then, assuming we replace the stream buff, the question is, where do we put the address we want to run? And we're going to have this object is going to have a vtable pointer and some other stuff. And that vtable pointer is going to have a slot for the uflow method. And that's where we want the pointer to be. So the answer I gave of the choices was a few bytes based on the vtable layout where this uflow slot is, after a location specified in a pointer near the beginning, which will be confused with the vtable pointer of streambuff and file streambuff. So questions on how I got the answer I got? Can I explain two again? So assuming we replace the file stream buff option object, the answer is different if we replace an iStream. Then this object has a vtable pointer at the beginning and some other stuff we don't actually care about. We want to make the vtable pointer point to something where when the code that's in this get method does this lookup here, it's going to find not the pointer to this uflow, well, the uflow method in the file stream buff, but to but a pointer we specify. So we're going to look at how the vtable is laid out there. So the question is, so my canonical answer is file stream buff and 2 and B, yes, that is my sort of canonical answer. I think it's not unreasonable to say that we do something with IF stream and something else. That would be another reasonable answer. So the question is, why is the vtable pointer in the buffer and not something else? So this buffer here is what we're confusing with. So basically, we have buffer and the file stream buff are sort of being confused with each other the same sort of way I said we'd have this foo and bar be confused with each other. So therefore, in this buffer, you know, the first slot that is just the beginning of the input is at the same memory location that the program thinks the vtable pointer is. So, other questions, follow-ups?
So this requires us to know, well, I guess the standard is in C that the vtable pointer is right at the top.
So the question is, how would we know where the vtable pointer is? So like the C++ doesn't actually specify that vtable pointers are used at all, but we look up what the calling convention for C++ is on our architecture to figure out how this would work. Or alternately, we like read the assembly that was generated for the program to figure this out.
I see.
Other questions? Okay, So to give a more concrete example, I'm going to go through, based on a blog post from the Google security people, an exploit from a 2012 bug in Google Chrome, which turned out to sort of win a bounty from Google because this was part of a chain of exploits that could be used to, at the time, escape Chrome's sandbox from a web page. So to run arbitrary code if you go to a web page in Chrome, obviously really bad. And sort of the key part of this was this use after free bug that was triggerable from JavaScript. And sort of what the use after free bug was is that you could allocate this sort of buffer for a video source, and you could have this pointer to the buffer that's represented in JavaScript by this buffer variable that was actually freed after you told the browser to, hey, here, I know you have this video element, let's just get rid of it, please. It would free the buffer, but you still have a pointer to it. And you could do something with this buffer for video data, and you could change, for example, and most notably in this exploit, this timestamp offset field. And the actual implementation of this is that this is JavaScript code, but this would call a C++ method. And it would call a C++ method on something that in this case, because of this code here, was already free. So that's our use after free. So the question is, what did the attacker do, you know, is going to do to make it so this does something bad? And to think about how that's going to work, you know, they need to look at, so what does that actually do? And well, it calls this set timestamp offset method, which goes through some indirection to this freed media source object. So this is the thing that was inadvertently freed. And that this call here is not a virtual call. It's not a virtual call because this method was not virtual. So there's no need to use a VTable lookup. There's no, you aren't allowed to have a subclass of this media source thing. Or rather, this wasn't virtual, but also this wasn't virtual because it was this media player doesn't have any subclasses. But this call here is a virtual call. And this is the one that was going to be targeted. So there's this member variable that holds a pointer to something that this does a VTable call, and it's one that could be triggered from JavaScript. So sort of the setup here is that in between here, the attacker is going to want to do something. So when this VTable call is triggered, it, instead of actually, you know, calling the real source set timestamp offset method, it ends up calling some function that they choose. And the code they use to do this, basically, after triggering the bug, they carefully wrote JavaScript code that would cause two different C++ objects to be allocated. One to replace this media source object, and the other one to replace this media player object. I should remember which. And one to replace what this private pointer pointed to, which was something called a player impl. That was the name of the C++ type. Because this was what was erroneously freed. So they allocated an array that was the same size as what that mPrivate pointer pointed to, the thing that the method call is made on. And they also allocated something to take the place of the media player object. Why did they do that? Because they needed it to be the case that that other memory allocations that would be made by JavaScript wouldn't interfere with this mPrivate field. So they allocated something that they knew the malloc implementation would place in the same place where this mPrivate field wouldn't be disturbed. So this first allocation, this is the place where they would do the work of replacing the vtable pointer. And conveniently, they could arrange for this array of ints in JavaScript to go to the same place as that thing, and then trigger a vtable call.
So are these exploits sometimes unreliable because it relies upon the discretion of allocation and deallocation that could maybe be different depending on other states of memory at the time?
So the question is, like, are these unreliable because we're relying on the allocator doing particular things? So usually the allocator, like, is not deliberately random. And even if it is, as I mentioned, we can do strategies like trying this multiple times. So until it, like, does something useful. Also, as we'll discuss later, often you might have ways of doing this where you can, like, kind of see if it works correctly. So, like, one thing you can do is you can check into the debugger. If I run this code, what's allocated where? And if the malloc implementation is deterministic, which it probably is, because why would you slow down your program with a randomness in your malloc implementation? Then it will just do the same thing every time, or roughly the same thing. And also, there's ways you can tell with, like, information leaks, you know, if something weird's happening, probably. But yes, it's like, it is tricky to make these reliable, but it's not like, but my understanding is that usually the technique works out to, you know, that it does the same thing every time because it's, you know, not code that uses randomness. So you can often make it work consistently, even if you have to do a bunch of work to figure out exactly what happens when. So question is, are we just changing the pointer to the vtable? Yes, that is ultimately what this code here is going to do. It's going to change the pointer to the vtable. So the question is, don't we need a fake vtable in memory to want what we want? Yes. So I'll get to, there's some missing pieces here, right? We have to know what do we put in here, and we'll talk about how they did that in a second. I should remove this line. So sort of what we're relying on is that the media player object, which was deleted, you know, we replace with this sort of WebKit RTC object, where it happens to be the case that the location of this mPrivate field is something that doesn't get changed in that object. So that's convenient because we want to make sure that this old pointer to something that's deleted with a vtable, you know, stays the same. And this array happens to get pointed to the same place as the player info object, and that's how we end up changing the vtable pointer. It's, you know, we have 64-bit pointers, presumably, array of 32-bit ints, so we just set the first two ints to change that pointer. So then there's a question of, like, how did we figure out addresses to put this here? And a key thing that this exploit took advantage of is that not only is this a way of running arbitrary code, assuming you know the address you want to use, it's also a way of leaking information. Because the same useAfterFree bug, if you allocate not an object with a vtable there, if you allocate, say, some object which has a pointer in the timestamp offset field, you could read the timestamp offset. So here we were doing this set timestamp offset method, but there's also was a get, which would retrieve this timestamp offset field. But if we allocated some object with a pointer in that slot, or like had a pointer to a buffer, for example, we would get the address of that buffer. As a double, we have to, like, figure out, wait a moment, this is a really weird double. What does that mean as an address? But that's some work we could do. And this is how the attack managed to figure out where things were in memory in order to be able to actually set the vtable pointer to an actually valid pointer and so on. So questions on this idea of this use after the same use after free, but with a different object replacing this media player as an information disclosure. And this kind of shows sort of why these use after free bugs become so dangerous, is that the attacker actually has, in real any real programs, lots of choice as far as sort of what ends up, you know, being confused with the freed object. So they can usually use that to manipulate it to do something useful. So that's on use after freeze. So I could talk about one more issue that comes up with allocations. And this one's mostly historical, so I'm going to be a little quicker on it. And this is about double freeze. So a common bug in programs that use malloc or delete is freeing something twice. Like, not with code like this typically, but sort of the way of, you know, the same sort of bugs that cause use after freeze often cause you to free things more times than you're supposed to. And this actually is often exploitable in a naive malloc implementation. But unlike use after free bugs, there's going to be actually a pretty easy fix for the malloc implementation to avoid. So let's look at why this ends up being exploitable with our sort of next pre version. So here I start out with thing is allocated in this space, and we call free once, and that's going to add it to our free list. And so what this does is that the head of the free list, let's say we add it at the beginning of the list, now points to the newly allocated thing, and the next pointer points somewhere. And then we free it again. Well, what are we going to do? We're going to add it to the head of the free list, and we're going to make it the next pointer, the first thing on the free list, point to something else. And so, like, we're going to end up with this situation. Why that's happening is because if you think of how do we add to the beginning of a linked list, well, we're going to set, you know, head next. So we have this thing. So we're going to do thing. Okay, apparently this is the time. We're going to do thing next equals head. And we're going to do head equals thing. This is how we add something to the beginning of a linked list. We set the next pointer of the thing we're about to add to where the list currently goes, and we just set the list to point to that thing. And this is what many malloc implementations did. And that meant you'd end up with this loop. That thing next, if it was already freed, would go back to the beginning, and the head of the list would this wouldn't actually change anything because it was already at the beginning of the list. And we'd end up with this loop. And this loop means that if we malloc twice, if these both of these mallocs take the first thing off the list, well, we end up with a scenario where we kind of get the same, where the malloc is using the same address multiple times. And this often ends up being, you know, sort of exploitable, the same kind of thing we have with use after free. But in this case, rather than it being a use after, you know, some dangling pointer, the problem is that these calls to malloc here end up returning the wrong pointers. And sort of the classic way that this was exploited is that we'd say after this first call to malloc, we'd overwrite these next and pre pointers. The attacker would, you know, manage to overwrite those pointers. And then some future call to malloc would use one of those overwritten pointers. And this would end up being, in many real programs, sort of an arbitrary write to whatever memory location you want. Sort of as a sort of walk through how this works, So sort of I've expanded out what this code might look like. So we have these two frees. So the first free will do something, will add the object to our free list. Okay. And we have, at this point, everything's fine. We have a normal list, linked list. Then the second free creates this cycle. And where this is going to be a problem is that our first malloc is going to, well, it's going to allocate that object, but, you know, our free first free object is something that's already allocated. So this is where we've gotten into trouble. Now malloc thinks that something that is actually allocated is free, and it's going to allocate it later. And sort of often the most straightforward way of taking advantage of this is that if we write over where the next pointer is, we can make malloc not continue allocating the same pointer over and over again, but eventually allocate the address we specify because it uses our overwritten next pointer. And then malloc returns this pointer to something which doesn't even have to be on the heap. Like it could be part of the global offset table, and that would say, let us overwrite the global offset table. Okay, so questions about sort of this double free idea. So the sort of key idea is that this can confuse malloc into, you know, allocating something that's still on the list of things to return from future malloc calls. So the question is, where did this pointer to the global offset table come? So this is assuming that after we do one allocation here, that, you know, we use something we allocate. So we allocate this space, which has a next pointer in it when it's viewed as a free object, and we write to the space that was allocated. But that space that is allocated, we have this use after free-like problem where there's two views. We can have the view of the size and the object, and we have the view of the size and the next and prev pointers. And because of this confusion, you know, we can overwrite, we can choose the value of this object, and malloc's going to view that value we write as a next and prev pointer. Does that answer the question of where did we get this pointer to the global offset table from? So the question is, so on the second malloc, we get an arbitrary write? Yes. On the third malloc, actually, because we need to, on the second malloc after we do this, overwrite the next pointer, we get an arbitrary write. So the one immediately after we overwrite this next pointer, we allocate this same space again because it's still the first free object. So this used to be a pretty big problem, but fortunately, unlike use after free bugs, double free bugs are actually pretty easy for malloc implementations to prevent. And the reason why is that malloc and new implementations can just check for this explicitly, that this scenario relies on us, you know, not knowing that we freed something that's already on the free list. And so what they'll commonly do is they'll change that, you know, size data to have a is it freed field, and they'll check that is it freed field, which was usually what was missing, on a free, and say and cause a crash if you free twice, rather than just doing the linked list operations as if everything was fine. And, you know, unlike some fixes we might have for, say, use after free, this is actually a very cheap change. It's one extra comparison basically on every free. And that's usually not a big deal compared to all the other stuff free and malloc are likely to do. But if we think of, you know, proposals like let's randomize where objects are, you know, that's probably a bit more expensive to make reliably prevent things. Or like adding guard pages, a lot more expensive. This is a very cheap fix and something that pretty much all current malloc implementations do. especially if they use this kind of linked list strategy. So questions on double freeze? Okay. So, sort of a logistical note. Originally, if you looked at the schedule, I was planning on like starting to cover sort of more techniques like stack canaries and other similar mitigations. I'm going to move that to later in the course. And instead, we're going to talk about some very principled approaches. We're going to start with sort of, you know, trying to actually fix a problem. And the big problem we've seen is that we have tons of bugs that are just all due to Tor bounds checking. Now, we've seen today that fixing bounds checking doesn't fix these sort of memory-based exploits, because all the use after free stuff, there's actually no bounds checking problems. All everything's in bounds. We're just confused about where pointing is. But we had a whole bunch of bugs which were about overflows. And, you know, I mentioned, well, you know, we can not use getS and things like that. But you might say, like, can we just fix it? Can we just add bounds checking? Can we just make it so when you do a, you know, some operation that manipulates a buffer, that it, you know, checks the bounds? And sometimes we do this. So for example, if you compile this code on a modern Linux system, it's going to check that length is less than or equal to 42. It's actually going to check that for you. And if you look at the assembly generated for this, you know, how this works is that there's this second version, this sort of secret version of memcopy called memcopycheck. And the compiler has, you know, determined that, oh, I know that buffer is 42 bytes, so I'm going to pass 42 as an argument. So it's going to turn this call here into this call to memcopycheck buffer attacker controlled len 42. And this memcopycheck function is going to do something with that 42 argument. Presumably it's going to, you know, crash rather than letting you overwrite the stack. Now, this is pretty weird, right? Because, you know, the compiler needs to have rules for all these functions. And obviously, it can't do this all the time. But for many standard library functions, this is done. And this is part of a feature that Linux and GCC call fortify source. And fortify source has sort of three different settings. And it adds, when depending on these settings, automatic checking to memcopy and a whole bunch of standard library string and array functions. It also is what, when we talked about printf format bugs, what disabled using %n is setting fortify source calls a version of printf that disables %n if the format string is not constant. And on modern Linux systems, it's enabled by default. And there are these three modes. So there's one, two, and off. You might say, so why is there three modes? Well, there's a backwards compatibility issue. And this came up actually in the subterfuge assignment. So in the subterfuge assignment, we mentioned that there's this call to getS that where we have a struct that has a buffer and a pointer. And the compiler, using this technique, inserted a check that the getS call of into that buffer in the struct doesn't exceed the bounds of the struct. And you might say, well, wait a moment, shouldn't it be checking it doesn't exceed the bounds of the buffer? Well, this is because that's compiled with this backwards compatibility mode that they didn't want to break code that intentionally decided that they'd have two buffers next to each other in a struct and exceed the bounds of one's to write the other. They wanted to make sure that if there was weird C code like that, it wouldn't break because people write weird C code. So that was this backwards compatibility mode. And the full mode, it would actually, you know, assume that you aren't doing that. But they didn't feel comfortable, you know, sort of making that the only setting because they would possibly break some weird old C programs. And this is going to be a recurring theme when we talk about how do we add bounds checking to C programs, is that what can we not break weird old C programs that do things that seem inadvisable? So the question is, why would it break? So the concern is that we might have a C program where there's a struct with, say, two character arrays next to each other, where the C program intentionally exceeds the bounds of the first array to write part of the second. Some C programs might do that, like when reading from files or something like that. And they need to deal, and they wanted to make sure that there was a version of this bounds checking that would never break those programs. Even though, you know, if you're talking about what C code you should write, I'm going to say, please never do this. But someone has, and it's probably a program that people care about and want to still work. Does that answer the question of why it would break? Okay. So this feature sort of handles a lot of things. So, for example, it adds checks to the memcopy. It does it if it's a stack or a global array. It can even do it in cases where you get, you know, part of the buffer. It can, like, figure that out. This is probably depends on whether you're using optimizations or not. But it doesn't always work. There's cases where it can't figure it out for... you know, even though, like, it has that support. So, for example, if you have this DES2 and you, you know, access some mystery pointer to it, the compiler is not going to manage to generate a checked version of this. Or if you have something like here, where RP can either be DES2, which is 1024 bytes, or DES3, which is 128 bytes, the compiler adds a check for this, but it adds a check for the largest possible size. Okay. So this is often useful. It finds many bugs, but it's not 100%, even for just for misuses of things like memcopy, where there isn't proper checking. Now, speaking of things about library functions, sort of a notable thing about some of the library functions is that some of them make this bounds checking really hard. So if we're thinking about memcopy, like, probably what should have happened in the code, if we don't have this fortify source feature, is that, you know, we should have some check of len. But there's some functions where we kind of need a version that lets us specify a size. So, for example, string copy, string cat, copy a string, concatenate a string, look for a null terminated string. So we need a bounds checking version of them. And the history of these bounds checking versions, so you would think string and copy, string and cat, string and printf, they take a size. The history of these is kind of bad. And a big problem is that, these bounds checking versions didn't exist for a while. And when they were added, there were some pretty poor choices made with some of these, in particular, these first two. I'm going to talk about that briefly. You know, so if we're thinking of fixing up C code, you might say, okay, so we have this string and copy, string and cat. So you might say, okay, so let's say I want to write source one concatenated with source two to dest. I want to do it with bounds checking, so this is the code I should write. Or alternately, this is the sort of code that Fortify Source should generate for me. And this doesn't do that. This is code that will go out of bounds. It will go out of bounds of dest. And that's really not intuitive. Because this is the version of string and copy and string and cat that take this extra size argument. So string and copy is string copy with a size and string cat with a size. So why doesn't it work to pass the size? But it doesn't. So let's look at exactly what goes wrong here. So let's start with string and copy. So string and copy, we have a destination, a source, and a size. And the reason why this can cause problems is that, here's from the manual on Linux, if there is no null byte among the first n bytes of source, where n is this size, the string placed in dest will not be null terminated. So what should our fix for this be? If I'm trying to write C code that doesn't go out of bounds, even if... I see what happened here. Sorry, the thing in quotes on the quiz answer should be backslash zeros. So that should be... So CND should be dest of some index equals backslash zero. And you can see from this warning that basically when they first created this sort of sized version of string copy, they figured that it was being used in a way where we didn't really care about having a null terminated string afterwards. And probably some C code was written that way. But that's not the typical use, and this causes many problems in actually making effective use of this function. So people who were trying to like not rely on the compiler generating the checks, because, well, that didn't happen for a very long time, you know, still got into trouble when they were trying to add these size checks because they just didn't work correctly because they didn't think about, oh, this doesn't actually add null termination. As majority of those who answered before I closed the quiz said, the canonical fix is you can explicitly set the last character of dest, which is size of dest minus one is the index because it's zero based, to null after the string copy. That is one possible solution that will make it null terminated, which is something we were expecting here because this percent %s means a null terminated string. The string in cat is perhaps more insidious. So it takes, again, a destination, a source, and a size, and it concatenates source to the end of dest, where dest is a null terminated string. And you'd think that this size, this n here, is the size of the destination. That's not what it is. It's the number of bytes from source to take. So what should we have done for that? I guess maybe I should clarify what string cat, which is this based on, does. So string cat if D equals foo and S equals bar, we'll make D equal to foo bar. Concatenates two strings together. Okay, since I'm out of time, so I believe something else is probably the best answer here. So because what we want to do is we want this n to be string len, which is not the same as size of dest, minus string len dest minus one, probably. Because we want to figure out how much space is left in dest for part of source 2. Okay. So questions on that? This is where I'll finish up today since I'm over time. Take other general
does
questions.
This also,
yeah.
Does this also fail to null terminate? Or does this null terminate? Oh, it does.
This null terminates, yes. And yes, it's confusing that you have to remember which of these do null terminate and which don't. So this is just poor API design, which is an unfortunate reason why, you know, C string manipulation code is really hard to write securely.
Sorry, can you explain the correct answer again?
So we want to make sure, so the n here is the number of bytes that are going to be added to dest, right? So I want to compute how much space is left in dest. So I take the size of the buffer minus the length that's already in there of the string that's already there, the foo, minus one for the null terminator.
Doesn't it not write source 2 bytes? It only writes like one minus source 2 bytes, because you'd think that source 2 already has a null terminator, right?
Source 2 already has a null terminator, but the string len doesn't like include the null terminator here.
Okay, that makes sense.
What if source 2 has less than the amount of free space left in dest?
Then this n, it will write, that's the maximum it will write, so.
Okay, so source 2 can still end.
Yes, it looks for a null terminator in source 2.
Okay, all right.
So as long as source 2 is null terminated, you're fine.
Gotcha.
Which are fixed to string, which are sort of assumption that the original code would do something useful assumes. Other questions?